Hello everybody, welcome. I'm an economist and econometrician who recently joined the MSc Department of Social Policy. But in my previous life, I was 17 years at the University of Essex at the Institute of Social and Economic Research, where amongst other things I was the director. But I was also the co-principal investigator at some times of the British Household Panel Survey and its successor, Understanding Society. So basically, I do data creation, well, I have in my past life, and I do a lot of longitudinal data analysis of a quantitative kind. But like Tom, I don't know much about social care. Incomes and labour markets has been my thing, but I've dabbled in, and I'll give you an example later on, of sort of related things. I'm going to talk about longitudinal data, as it says, and the subtitle is important. I'm going to be talking about multi-topic general-purpose household surveys. Whereas Barbara is following me, who's going to talk about the birth cohort surveys. So just before we want to get going, I'd say, as we shall see, there are two main types of longitudinal data. I'm not going to make a distinction between these household panel surveys and cohort surveys. So I agree with Tom's statement about the UK being a world leader in terms of longitudinal data, longitudinal resources. But I disagree with him about the birth cohorts being the crown jewels, or at least the only crown jewels. There are, in this royalist weekend to come, we can say that there are heaps of crown jewels out there, and household panel surveys, which the ESRC is putting huge amounts of dosh into, are also big in this front. So, longitudinal data. I'm going to be talking about sort of general stuff about longitudinal data, and excuse me if I'm telling you how to suck eggs, but I'm not sure where to start in this, and move towards the end, towards some examples. So just to be clear, longitudinal data is sometimes, if you were in biomedical statistics, you would refer to as repeated measures. Essentially, what you're doing is following people, or it could be other institutions like firms, you're following them and collecting data from the same units, the same people, over time. So it's like a movie, you're following over time. This should be your contrast with the most commonly used alternative for tracking over time, which is repeated cross-section data, which is where you follow over, go over time, but you collect data from different sets of people. So an example of the poverty statistics that come out every year in the Family Resources Survey, that the Family Resources Survey is essentially a survey that collects data from different sets of people last year from the set of people who are surveyed this year. Longitudinal data, you take a group of people and follow them over time. The same people, repeatedly. Okay, so for example, if you wanted to study income changes associated with changes in individuals' disability status, and this is an example I'll consider later on, doing it with longitudinal data, you take a sample of people, for example, who move from being non-disabled to disabled, and look at what's happening to their income and other sorts of characteristics. So the focus is on tracking the same set of people over time. This is not the same as doing it with repeated cross-section data, where you might have the average income of the people, all the people who are not disabled in one year, and you compare that with the incomes of people who are disabled in the same or some later year. So there's a really key basic difference. So I'm going to talk about the rationales for longitudinal data and research, give you an introduction to design, but won't say much about cohorts, that's my successor's discussion, and then focus on household panels. Do stop me at any time, otherwise I'll just rabbit on. Okay, so why might you think about using longitudinal data? Lots of reasons, and people draw upon various ones in different contexts. The first several are very descriptive ones, just in a sense learning more about how the world is before trying to understand it and do something about it. People talk about the differences between net change and gross change. Basically it's saying cross-sectional rates of something, so the proportion of people who are unemployed in this year and last year, doesn't tell you anything about who's moving into or out of unemployment, or disability status, or whatever. So net changes are basically what you see are the rates in any given year. Gross change is telling also about the flows. So And the advantages about the flows is, of course, once you've got the flows, you can also work out what's happening to the proportions. So that's the first bit. The second thing is that many aspects that we're interested of about life are actually defined in an inherently longitudinal sense. So an example might be poverty persistence. So how long are people poor? Whether people are stuck in poverty or welfare dependence, to take a more topical example. You know, the notion of dependence is something that, you know, requires time, the process of unfolding of time, for to actually define the concept, unlike an unemployment rate in a particular year or a particular point in time, which is inherently cross-sectional. And then you can expand that. You can, with longitudinal data, you can take spell-based perspectives. You can not just say how much or how many at a particular point in time. You can say, take a people in a particular state and see how long they're in there and what are the factors associated with entry, factors associated with exit, and how that relates to how long they've been in the state. Then moving on to understanding and trying to model these things, one of the advantages of longitudinal data is that the fact is that you've got repeated observations on the same individuals. And that allows you, in a broad sense, to control for unobserved differences. So there is stuff that you don't know about people. You may have a very rich set of characteristics in these longitudinal data sets, but there's some things you may never actually manage to measure, either because it's unobservable or because it's unobserved. But essentially, over time, you can, if those things are fixed over time, then you can difference them out by taking the repeated, using the repeated observations. And if you're familiar with these sort of things, I'm talking about what economists would refer to as fixed or random effects models. So this is getting us closer and closer to causal models of understanding. And of course, the fact of pure fact of having longitudinal data, you've got temporal ordering, and that helps as well in terms of the causal stories. So there are lots of different sorts of data and designs out there. I'm going to be talking mostly about surveys and panels, and I'll explain what I mean by that shortly. But in the medical area, randomized controlled trials are a form of longitudinal data design. They're much more focused in their purposes than what I'm going to be telling you about. But essentially, they are following the same set of people over time, and it's essentially a control group and a treatment group, and looking at the differences between them. But they're essentially longitudinal data. But surveys aren't the only way to go. You could also have administrative record data, where you link the records together. So for example, you might go to the Department for Work and Pensions and link together earnings histories, for example, with national insurance contribution records. You might link together education records through the pupil level annual school census, etc., etc. These are great, you know, wonderful big data sets, but they're often created for bureaucratic purposes, running the benefit system, running it at home, and so on. So they're not always perfect. They've got this comprehensive coverage of, you know, for what they were designed to do, and it's often said that measurement error is relatively low because this is the story, basically. But on the other hand, are we all using them? No, we're not in the Nordic countries. Britain, like a number of other countries, is very concerned about confidentiality, privacy, basically, and wants to control access for some good reasons, some bad reasons. These are not so widely used. But they are increasingly being used. There's some users being used in secure environments for two things. Well, they've always been used as the sample frame for surveys. So I won't say much about that, but increasingly, and I'll refer to this later, administrative record linkage of various kinds is being used to provide additional data for surveys. And I might mention an example later, but probably well as well, in terms of the cohorts. So let's now talk about longitudinal survey designs, and I'm going to sort of hone in on panel surveys and getting there. But first, I want to make a distinction between prospective and retrospective designs. The distinction between prospective ones and retrospective is how you get the data. Essentially, in prospective design, the data collection is taken from now, you draw a sample, and then you follow them from now into the future. And so essentially you have an interview or some other data collection process now, and then you get the next set of data next year, and the year after that, or if it's a monthly data collection, month by month. You know now what's coming for retrospective data collection, you do one big data collection now, and then you look backwards, and if it's a survey, you ask respondents about what they were doing last year or the year before, and so on, build up histories looking backwards. Okay, so there are two ways of doing it. Both have been used a lot in Britain, and you can compare them in various ways. And on this slide, I've got in the left-hand column a series of headings that sometimes under which they're compared, and then comparing the two designs. So, for example, an important thing is actually to get hold of the data and be able to adapt over time to new research issues. The advantage of retrospective designs is that they're really quick. You're doing it once, and you collect all the data going backwards at one time. Prospective survey is, by definition, slower because we have to do our sample now, wait till next year, the year after, and so on. So basically, you have to be patient. And I can tell you that's an issue with getting funders involved in these sort of things. Cost associated with what I've just been telling you about, other things being equal, prospective design can be often costlier simply because you have to maintain the sample, track them over time, and so on. Narrative consistency, this is where I'm referring to longitudinal history data. We want to collect it. If you ask somebody in a retrospective survey what you were doing at particular times in their life, you can set up various calendars and so on, and in a sense force people to reconcile their stories while you've got them there in front of you. Now, that's not quite so easy in a prospective design, simply because you don't see, it's a year before you, or 6 months before you come back to the same people. So getting people's stories consistent is a bit more complicated. Of course, then there is potential issues about bias. Recall bias is an issue that's often raised in terms of retrospective surveys. Ask yourself how much you earned last year. Got a good idea? Well, you've probably got a rough idea. How about the year before that? Even worse. You might be able to refer to a tax form if you know about that. What about your kids' birthdays, however? Probably know about that. Okay, so depending on what you're actually, the sort of issues in people's lives that you're interested about, these retrospective designs may be more or less reliable. But it's because we're interested in things like earnings, details of employment and so on, that is why we typically rely on prospective designs, so we get this repeated measurement and so on, and not relying on recall. So for things like hatches, matches and dispatches, and histories of those over people's lives, also broad occupational histories, retrospective surveys might be okay, but for many other things, prospective designs are basically the way to go. There's also issues about non-response. Retrospective surveys have this issue about survivor bias. If you take a survey now, for example, of older people and want to ask them about what they were doing in their working lives, the people you have in front of you, say age 60 and over, are the people who have survived that particular point of view. Those people who are less healthy might may not literally be alive, or there may be other characteristics that make them less willing to participate in surveys. On the other side of the coin, prospective designs have the potential issue of attrition bias, or otherwise known as sample dropout or loss to follow-up. And that's an issue. You can do something about it, but it is also an issue. So essentially, you have horses for courses. That's the bottom line. The choice of design is dependent on your research goals and focus. I'm now going to focus on prospective designs, which are panel surveys, the example being panel surveys. And this is where you essentially follow a group of people over time. You have sequences of interviews. These are often called waves, though Barbara's going to call them sweeps, I suspect, because that's what the cohort people tend to refer to them. Same thing, it's a round of interviews or data collection. And there's lots of variation here. Certainly in terms of these panels, there's a distinction between an indefinite life survey and a fixed life one. Basically, you can have a single panel, a group of people starting off, and essentially you're going to follow them in indefinitely. Well, indefinitely typically means at least as far as we can and as long as we get funded to do so. Alternatively, there are often rotating panels, which is where you take multiple overlapping panels where you're going to follow people for a fixed amount of time in advance. The main example of that in Britain is the labour force survey, where there are quarterly interviews with a group of people, but in each quarter there is a new sample started. People are followed for five sweeps, five waves each quarter, but there's an overlapping sample. So at any given quarter you have a very big cross-sectional sample, which is built out of overlapping cohorts. The other distinction is about the sampling unit and the population which the survey aims to represent. And a big distinction here is whether the focus is entirely at the individual level or on individuals within their household context. And I'm essentially going to talk about, in more detail, about individuals within their household context, but we're talking about in the focus essentially being following individuals. It's to do with how you follow people over time, which people you follow over time, and how whether or not you replenish the sample with new members. And of course, there's lots of, you can classify the surveys according to the sorts of information that you collect. Although I made this distinction between retrospective and prospective designs earlier, in fact, most household panels, and including the ones I'm going to talk about later, also have long retrospective aspects in there as well. Basically, it's because A, these things, you know, things like work histories and so on are of intrinsic importance, and I can tell you that it's also a way of having longitudinal data quickly so you can deliver some longitudinal information to funders. It may sound a bit of a joke, but it's true. Okay, examples of panel surveys. I won't talk about birth cohort surveys, but there are the cohort surveys, but I just point out that there are not only birth cohort surveys, but there are surveys of young people. There are also surveys of older people that are around there. Particularly important. And just to remind you too that it's not just the social sciences, and there's also lots of other social experiments out there, and increasingly in Britain, program evaluations of things like the New Deal for Low Parents, Sure Start. There are evaluations of these been based on cohort designs where the focus is on the individual. Rotating and perpetual panel surveys, on the other hand, are following individuals in their household context. I've mentioned the labour force survey, and I'm going to talk about now a perpetual design, these household panel surveys. Essentially, they're designed in a particular way to maintain representativeness of the sample population over an extended period of time. Mostly these are interested in the private household population of a particular country, so individuals who constitute the private household population. So I have to say straight up, that misses out the very small fraction of the population who are homeless, for example, because they're not in the private household population. And it also means some institutions are missed out. And the idea is to maintain, through the design, which is not just how you choose the initial sample, but also how you follow people over time, to maintain representativeness of that group over time. There are substantial issues here, however, that have reared their heads. So, for example, in the original panel surveys in both the US, Germany, and the UK, what you ask yourself, what happens if there's substantial immigration into a country over a period of time? So, for example, take in Britain, the survey I'm going to talk about later, the British Household Panel Survey, was samples drawn in 1991, then subsequently a lot of immigration into Britain. The same was the case for the German Household Panel, which started in 1984. And if you want to say something about what's going on in the private household population, the trouble is it's changed over time. So what do you do about it? Well, in the short term, there's often a lot that you can do about it, and that's a particular problem. But the thing that people have done, and they have done both in Britain and in Germany, is to take refreshment samples. So basically you take a new sample and meld it onto the original one and follow them over time. So here's a big long list of longitudinal surveys. The granddaddy of them all is the panel study of income dynamics that started in 1968. in the US. There were then a series of smaller studies around Europe, both in the Netherlands, Sweden, Germany, all starting in early 1990s. The German panel, CERP, is the longest running one, starting in 1984, still going. British Council Panel Survey, which I'm going to talk about. There are subsequent surveys based on basically the German design and the British Council Panel design. Canada, Australia, New Zealand, European Community Household Panel, which ran for 8 years from the middle of the 90s to 2001 for the old 15 member states of the EU. There is now the EU statistics on income and living conditions, which there's one component of it, has a four-year rotating panel in it. And there are various others, including all around the world, Indonesia, Korea, South Africa, and so on. So household panels are a big thing all around the world. And of course, some heterogeneity in what's going on. So, you know, for example, in the panel study of income dynamics, the data collection was all done via a household reference person. So one person is responding to provide information about everybody within the household. So, do all husbands know what their wives earn, and vice versa? Ask yourself. So, differences, key innovations in the German and the British panels are that all adults, or all people 16 and over, are asked themselves, as well as a household respondent. More about that later. So, this is BHPS. This is the the big daddy of household panel surveys in Britain. Began in 1991, with a sample of around 5,500 households, covering 10,000 adults and around 14,000 altogether. Because when you add in kids, there were just under 14,000 individuals for whom data was collected. So the sample frame, we want to get hold of private household population, private household population. So like major surveys in Britain, the postal address file is used for the sampling frame, and then there are various design aspects. It uses a clustered and stratified sample for both efficiency in basically data collection and subsequent inference. It's essentially an equal probability sample. If you're interested in that, we can come back to that and talk about it later. And as I said before, interviews are with all adult members who are age 16 and above of these original households. And then these people are followed over time and re-interviewed. Then was done in essentially the autumn of every year. So September, October was where the interviews were concentrated, and for various reasons would sometimes be a bit longer. But this was an indefinite life panel, but indefinite meant, in fact, running for 18 waves through to autumn 2008. And I'll tell you what happened after that shortly. Following rules, so we want to maintain the representativeness of the private household population, so how do we do it? So basically, you get the you follow people within the survey in the same way in which the population reproduces itself. So immigration aside, how does the population reproduce itself or die? Basically, it has kids turn into adults. So what happens in the survey is that when the kids who were in the below 16, but turn 16, they start getting interviewed in their own right. We're following people over time, so if a household splits up, husband and wife split and go different directions, each of those individuals are followed and interviewed in their own right. So the process of mobility in a geographic and other sort, in a sort of life course sense, is mimicked with the sample design, the so-called following rules. So that is essentially the way in which the sample design replicates the household population out there. People are moving, yes. One key thing that may be particularly important for social care applications is the difficulty of what happens if people go into institutions and so on. So this might be care homes, but it also might be prisons and so on. Beginnings of the BHPS is an example of where the sample members have gone out of scope. So some data collection is done for them, but there's a limit to what you can do. Similarly, if people migrate out of the country, or similarly, if they die. I mean, clearly you can't follow them. I say that it's not entirely only a joke or a bad joke, but the point is that you can actually collect quite a lot of information from administrative record and registration data about people who've died, so you can link that information in. So there is some stuff that you can say. There are issues, of course, that the sample is reduced by attrition that I told you about before, people becoming ineligible, but that doesn't mean everything is hopeless. Sampling weights are provided by the organisers of the survey to make some adjustment for these sort of things. The sample has developed over time. I said there were around 1,400 at the beginning. By wave 9, there were almost 20,000 associated with the sample because of the processes that I were telling you about. And then with these, in fact, there were additional samples. So here's another example with the BHPS about how you adapt to change over time and new interests. Of course, we know during the 90s, particular interest in devolution in Britain, and associated with that, there were a series of new samples added on to the BHPS, so around 1997 and thereafter, for Scotland and Wales, and then Northern Ireland said, I want to be in too, and they were. Okay, so that basically means that there are now larger samples for these particular groups, and you can do some regional breakdowns. You might wonder about response rates. Well, the response rates at the beginning of the BHPS correspond quite well with the same general purpose surveys that are around at the time. So for example, the family expenditure survey, what is now the family resources survey, and so on. So around two-thirds of eligible households have given complete interviews, more if you take into account incomplete interviews, and so on. But what happens going on thereafter? Like most longitudinal surveys, you lose the most at the beginning, so you lose just over 10% in the first year. But the wave response rate thereafter, through to around wave 18, is only about 5% a year. So response is pretty damn good in this case. There is, of course, people don't provide perfect information or complete information in every way. There is an issue of non-response. It varies a lot depending on what you're asking people about. If you ask them what their age and sex is, you get pretty reliable information. If you ask them what their income is, particularly if they're self-employed, less reliable. And also people may give just simply either not know or be less willing to give a response. So there is stuff in that provided by the data producers, imputed values and so on. So it's not entirely hopeless. Data are collected in lots of different ways. Essentially, there's an interview, but there is information collected about the household itself, because remember, we're interested in the household context. So there is a household question, there are individual questions, self-completion questions about attitudes and values, and so on. There's actually a young people's questionnaire for those aged 11 to 15. And corresponding to each of these questions, there's essentially a short interview, 10 to 15 minutes, with a household reference person collecting stuff about the household as a whole and their housing. Each adult respondent provides information, and kids and so on. Personal interviews, it started off using pen and paper, computer-assisted stuff was added later on. Okay, this is why the survey is not focused on social care. Basically, it does lots of things, covers lots of topics, lots of purposes. Covers everything from demography of individuals and households, education and training, health and caring, labour force participation, attitudes and values, income and wealth, housing and consumption. And the good thing about it is it's not just that it has information about each of them, is that you can look at these life course events in parallel at the same time. That's the whole point. I'll skip that. Okay, so here's information about, we can get loads more documentation and stuff, and you'll see this in the slides that get left behind today. There's the extra data. Okay, so understanding society. BHPS had basically run its course by the end of the 1980s, to some dissatisfaction with issues of the sort that I was talking about. Couldn't cover immigration issues, couldn't cover ethnic minorities and other small groups and so on. So essentially a big new opportunity came along to have a new survey, and this is Understanding Society. Terrible name, but that's what it is. Basically, it's very big, and it also incorporates the BHPS. It started interviews in 2009. It's run from the same place as the BHPS. It got money from the Large Facilities Capital Fund, which is essentially a big science fund that usually buys telescopes, Arctic research ships, and things like that. But somebody had an inspired idea to fund social science survey. It's a resource, after all. Funding also comes from ESRC and government department co-funders, and the whole idea is to expand the scope, be much more ambitious. And it's the largest single investment in academic social research, so bigger than any of the both cohorts so far, but may not be as big as the next both cohorts ever. So, give you an idea, large numbers, 100,000 individuals in 40,000 households. Okay, so that's, depending on how you do it, about three times bigger than the BHPS. Lots of different samples, general purpose sample, there's an ethnic minority booth sample, there's an innovation panel for methodological work, and the BHPS sample is tracked along. So there is now, the Wave 9 team of BHPS is now in Understanding Society. So, if you've got many sample numbers, you can look at small size groups in great interest, disabled people, regional and sub-regional variation, particular events and so on. New content, as I said, ethnic minorities. Biomedical data is now included, including physical measures. So instead of just asking people how tall they are and how heavy they are, there are physical measures, and fluids are taken. So DNA is being collected via blood. For various groups, data administrative record linkage of various kinds, education, health and hospital records, income tax and benefits to come, overcoming various issues that have to be done. And of course, geocoded linkage is possible on multiple geographies. So you can see that it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So basically the survey has just started, so there aren't any longitudinal data yet available. The survey is so big that instead of the field work being done just in the autumn, it's spread out over not just 1 year, but over 2 years. So there are basically 24 monthly samples. So the waves, carry annually, annual data collection as for the BHPS, but there are overlaps in the different waves. Some of the data are available. So household panels have done lots of stuff. This is just some of the ISA books that have come out, and there are thousands of articles by ISA people and others. I could talk about my example on disability and disadvantage, but I've overrun, haven't I, Tom?
I think you should. Perhaps leave that up so people can take the reference.
I'll just give you. Well, they'll get the copy of the slide.
But I think just to give people a chance before they get another notes from Barbara
I'll give 2 minutes, 1 second on the context. What do we know about disability in Britain? Virtually all have been derived from cross-sectional data. And so to go back to my initial slide about saying how disadvantaged were disabled people in Britain compared to non-disabled people, all from cross-sectional data, nothing about movements into disability, how long people stay there and so on. So this is just an early piece of work using BHPS, very descriptive, but making a key distinction between disadvantage associated with pre-existing circumstances and showing that the people who became disabled were typically overrepresented from the, tended to be disadvantaged before they started. And then looking at what happened the longer people remained disabled, what happened to their conditions, income and employment. Anyway, that's enough of me.
Great, thanks.
Sorry for going. Just,
yes, so people can get the Journal Social Policy 2004.
Yes, but they'll get the slides.
They'll get the slides. Yeah. Right, brilliant. Thanks, Sim. Sim, for that wonderful overview. Catch your breath a bit for 5 or 10 minutes, but chance to ask questions, and I think I should emphasize that the questions can be at any level of sophistication or non-sophistication, so don't feel afraid about that. And I'll just wash my mouth out with soap, I stand completely corrected. All I can say is that in our report, the ONS, which we're presenting tomorrow, number one conclusion is use Understanding Society as the main vehicle for measuring well-being.
So great.
Any questions or just responses? The slides will be circulated. Not.
So I'll make two comments. Firstly, thank you very much, Stephen, very good presentation. Secondly, I've never previously heard the expression hatches, matches, dispatches, but I love it. And thirdly, I just want to sort of throw the discussion out to other people. So I know some people in the room have used BHPS to, or have looked at BHPS as a possible, maybe in Italian society, as a possible vehicle for social care research. And I just wonder whether, you know, they might want to comment on the suitability, you know, how useful they found that. So people that have got, I mean, Raphael probably knows a bit, but I don't want to put people on the spot, but if there are people that have got some experience of that, it would be helpful just to have your thoughts to log back to Stephen. Nobody wants to? No? Okay. I just wanted, because you, in your own questions, if there's health and caring is included as a dimension, and that sort of alerted me to the possibility there might be some social care.
I guess it would depend on what you think, what counts as social care, and I'm ignorant about that. Certainly if you were wanting to look at people in their in an institutional context, it would not be particularly good for us. But there is a lot about caring. I mean, because everybody in the household is asked about caring and whether or not they're caring for people. And you can put that along, and people have done work on how that interacts with labour force behaviour and so on. The development of, you know, caring histories, and it's not just childcare, it's care for anybody. Health conditions, there is lots, I mean, a lot of, in the BHPS, there is not a lot of, there's no physical data collection in the biomedical sense. There's not a nurse visit, as there is in understanding society, and getting out the equivalent of tape measures and other sorts of things. But there's a lot of health conditions, there's stuff about health service usage, attitudes and values to different sorts of services. And of course, you can put it together with, you know, everything about, you know, where they live, who they live with, their work and occupational histories, and so on. So I guess it'd be easy to answer the question if I know what sort of questions people are interested in.
One of the areas that I would be interested in data on things like receipt of home care, attendance at day centres, or nowadays in the world of personalisation, I guess, receipt of personal budgets and direct payments.
Yeah.
Attended, I think, Tuzansa maybe more most recently, and the Nelson's, you know, wave 5, actually not just wave 6, really, I should have said, but gradually building up the ways it's collected more variables on use of social care from wave 6, is quite a lot more in it.
Yeah.
I'm up to date with that, the study side, has that got more in it than the BHPS did, rather?
On different sorts of payments?
On both receipt of different types of community-based care and on other pays for it as well, actually.
I have to say, I don't know off the top of my head. There was a lot, in the BHPS it has collected information on incomes coming from up to 39 different sources, you know, to that. And part of that is because Britain's got such a really complicated benefit system, and that includes disability benefits for various kinds, and so on. And understanding will be adapt, you know, is taking into account the changes in legislation and so on. But as for, and of course takes into account so-called private transfers between individuals paying, you know, both and also payments out as much as. But to be honest, I don't know the precise answer. What, you know, who is going to? Sorry, I can't help. I don't know the exact question, but the website, I think, will have that.
There's not an individual attached to each of those headings in the.
Have you been?
Well, I mean, education and training, or health and caring, or.
Oh yeah, no. Everybody, each individual, because the whole.
No,
point
sorry. I meant within the BHPS team or the Understanding Society team. Is there an individual?
It doesn't work that way. I suppose it does in a rough sort of way. But there's not a if you want to know about health, ring X. Yeah, broadly speaking. I mean, ring Amanda Sacker, who you know, or Yvonne Kelly.
Just a very basic question. From what time onwards do you actually call something that only children study? I mean, like, how long does it have to be? 2 years.
Repeated observations?
Two
you get repeats after.
Even if it's every year?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Harvey Goldstein from Platts would say all you need is, you know, them being in one class in a school at one point and the next class at another point, so much less than a year.
I mean, obviously, if you're, it partly depends what you're interested in doing. Well, if you're only looking at a transition at a particular point in time, you know, you only need two observations. But if you want to be more ambitious about doing things like controlling for unobserved differences, the more that you observe the people over time, the more that their behaviour will reveal what that unobserved thing is that, you know, that might be affecting behaviour.
Can I ask one question?
Sure.
For developing countries, I mean, like, if you would actually think of applying household surveys in South Africa, as you said, like, that has been done, you would almost, I mean, has it been used to almost manipulate policy in a way, because you would miss all the townships or the population, I mean, probably you would miss a huge...
Well, I have to be careful because I'm not an expert on this, but the South African survey to which I'm referring is, I'm sure it's done its best in terms of population coverage. Including, you know, issues of sort of what you count as a home or homelessness, it clearly becomes more important, and in a society in which there's a huge amount of internal migration, becomes an issue for following rules. But I mean, the survey people know this, and so there and a lot of these flows are seasonal, so there's something you can do about it. And there are then you also use innovative. You adapt the design to try and take account of this by, you know, relying on other people in the household to say where other people have gone. I mean, you can't run exactly the same design everywhere. I mean, just simply there are natural. And some of the original South African survey, in fact, focused on particular geographical areas. So there's, I can't remember the exact name, KwaZulu-Natal, somewhere in a particular geographical focus. The Indonesian survey is a national one, for example, following the household over time. Well, the developing country longitudinal surveys typically haven't followed individuals. They haven't used the same following rule. They've tried to follow households, reflecting a different sort of design. I mean, I think it's problematic, and it's, the development literature has pointed to this, because, you know, if you're... One of the slides I didn't show you was to say that there is basically the message is there's no such thing as a longitudinal household. You can only follow individuals over time and look at their household context. Why can't you follow households over time? Because there's no such thing as in general, as a stable household. People come together into households, households split. So you can't just sort of define a set of households in your initial sample and follow household one over household over time, year two, year three, because there's no such thing. You can follow the individuals who were in the original household, and that's basically the following all of these results.
Thanks. Next one.
Sorry,
no, it was in between, it was actually Lady Green first.
Apparently, you do have something in there about contacts with some services, like social work, and obviously it's very low percentage, 20% or something. But potentially, do you use that data? Could you control for enough things that you could look at something to do?
You could, with caution. I mean, if you have a look at this article, you can see that the actual numbers of disabled people in the BHPS is relatively small. So even pooling over the first 8 waves, we're looking at several hundred. So that's going to limit what you can do. And that's why I understand one of the reasons for having Understanding Society is that by having such a huge sample, you know, you're going to try and guarantee that you have at least some minimum, you know, cell sizes for particular population groups of interest.
And do you know if those questions about service contact, they will be in Understanding Society as well?
My guess is yes, but I better not say yes, but I'm 100% confident.
Is that easy to get, or which variables you've asked, is that all?
If you just go to... there are two routes to getting there. Go to understanding.org.uk, the website, and look under documentation or heading, or go directly to the UK Data Archive, esds.ac.uk, and have a look at the catalogues, and all the documentation is also there, and it's in 5 minutes you could tell us what variables are there.
Just a couple of questions. It relates back to just something you said I found quite interesting. You said that you couldn't follow households over time necessarily. Are you therefore really measuring families or family connections over time, not necessarily blood families, but families.
Oh, all sorts. All
so, so in a sense, you're not necessarily following individuals over time, but families and what happens.
No, 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 literally following individuals, because those, because only you can only consistently follow individuals, because it, you know,
so you're not really looking at the connections.
Well, you can, of course you can, because that's by the design, and it's unlike a cohort design where there's just basically one target individual within the household. Mm-hmm. You've got everybody within the original sample is of interest. So, you know, if a couple splits, you follow each of them into their new context, but because it, with the accumulation of data over time, you can always, you know, look at the amazing complexities of people's lives. So people, kids who grow up and leave home are followed into their new arrangements, their students, and if they stay with the sample, into jobs and so on. And if they marry, so somebody joins them in a new household, their new partner is also interviewed, and we get information about them. If they have a kid, that kid becomes part of the sample, and you know, and so on, it reproduces. So, it is really about, you know, the household context and the relation. There is very detailed information about family and household demographies. There's a wonderful file called the Alt-Ego file, which tells you the relationship in each household, for example, of everybody to everybody else.
So you're actually looking at social networks as well. Okay.
Well, within households and families, not social networks in the sense of local communities and other sorts of things. Though there are questions that have been used to look at these things where people are asked who their best friends are.
Okay.
Three best friends and etc.
And just with the new sort of super duper survey, you're looking at ethnic minorities, and how are you categorising those? Are you looking, you know, are you looking at every single different ethnic minority in the UK?
Good point. In the ethnic minority boost sample, focuses on the five of greatest interest. And don't tell me to say
So the five greatest interest to who?
In terms of relative numbers and in terms of some. So let me try this and see how many I get to. So Afro-Caribbean, Chinese, Indian, Bangladeshi, Black African. Is it, might be at least.
Pakistan?
Yeah, did I say that? Indian, Pakistan, Bangladesh. Yeah, so Indian subcontinent and so on. So those are the main ones there. But of course, in the main population sample, people's ethnicity is also connected. So there are, I mean, there's basically, you know, so there's not only the white majority in the national comparison sample, but also other, you know, all sorts of minorities. The collection of lots of in the boost sample, lots of collection about where people were born, particularly if it was outside the UK. In fact, where their grandparents were born, and all sorts of details. So again, sort of social networks of a different kind. Okay.
Right,
so
one last one, and then we should move on to
God. Just in relation to that, I was just wondering what sort of immigration status people needed to have to be part of the sample, and if somebody was like living with another person that was sort of an illegal immigrant or something, is a person's sort of rights safeguarded there, or could them coming into contact with the survey sort of prove reliability?
So there's two questions, really, essentially. One is whether or not are they eligible people, so are illegal migrants eligible to be sampled in the sample design sense? Answer, yes. It's a sample of the UK private household population. So if they are living in a private household, when the interviewer shows up, you know, they're in. Okay, there are maybe problems subsequently in following them over time, trying to find them the next year, you know, because of their status now, that makes it difficult. They may have moved on for various reasons. The second question you ask is about is the ethical one, about what, you know, essentially data confidentiality. And there is a complete data confidentiality. This has nothing to do with the government. Or, you know, or no information is ever passed on to, you know, the whatever it's called, the border force now. It's nothing to do with it. In the same way that we've been been collecting for two decades information about people's incomes and earnings, and none of that ever goes near HMRC. I mean, it's those ethics issue. You know, this is it, the survey is introduced as a survey run by the University of Essex, probably, and there are various ethics, you know, stuff that go with it. All the physical measure stuff that I refer to in and collection of blood, etc., has been through the various relevant medical ethical committees and so on and so on. So ethics are really important to us.
Okay, I think we'll have to move on. Thank you very much again, Steve. I just asked, how many people are employed in the survey, the data collection?
It's difficult to distinguish it because it's a large amount of money. BHP has cost over $1 million a year to run. That has to be contracted out, so it's done to a survey organisation. I don't know how many they use. Right, within ISA,
hard. I meant more with them.
But put it another way, all these survey organisations think it's really good to have either the cohorts or the household panels on their CV. Yeah. It basically generates them business because they're quality surveys.
Okay, thank you, Stephen.